very important in the case of both the second and third readings that you put them in the context of last week's readings. Remember last week Paul was going on and on about many members making up one body and all the members depending on each other. And with the gospel, we had Jesus showing up in his hometown, and everybody was all hot to hear him because he said, oh, he's done all these wonderful things in Capernaum, which was only a few miles away. And then he hits him in the head with his complaint. And they want to kill him. Pretty interesting development, it seems to me. Okay, but I would like to address this marvelous lyrical passage from Paul to the Corinthians. This is Paul at his most lyrical. Paul is sort of transported by what he was talking about and what he was thinking about. And you remember, again, that's why last week's reading is so important. Because he was talking about all these gifts, you know, and sure enough, the Corinthians, who have been described as being able to misunderstand anything that Paul wrote or said to them, said, well, I can speak in tongues. Glossolalia, which is still around in some quarters today. I can prophesy. I know all kinds of things about faith, blah, 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 blah. Therefore, it must follow that I am superior to you. That's the conclusion that the Corinthians drew, or some of them. And again, Paul, with a frontal assault, says, no, none of that counts for anything. And it's important to remember that the division of the New Testament into chapters happened about 400 years after Paul died, Jesus died, they all died. So you have to, when you're reading the New Testament, as I hope you do, you have to be aware that there is no break between chapter 12 and chapter 13. They're of a piece. And chapter 13 depends on chapter 12 because the Corinthians, like most of us, will use anything as bragging points. You know, I must be better than you because blah, 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 fill in the blanks. And Paul says, that's all rubbish. Folks, you missed the point. Again, the point of this multi-membered body that Paul talked about. As I said, that's borrowed from Stoic philosophy, where the Stoic philosophers say, well, we need plumbers, and we need carpenters, and then we need philosophers, and then we need musicians, blah, 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 blah. So they're all interconnected. The basis for that interconnection was purely strategic, as I said last week. We need you. If my toilet backs up, well, they didn't have toilets, but if my pipes break, then I need a plumber. Plumber, what's a plumber compared to a fine musician? Not much. Except Paul says, the criterion whereby you judge these people, or I judge myself, is drastically different from the Stoic criterion, which is purely strategic necessity. Have to have my roof fixed. I'll call a carpenter. No. That won't wash. In other words, Paul, following Jesus, was clear-sighted. This always struck me the last few years that the most remarkable thing about this man, Jesus, was his clear-sightedness. You know, he wasn't put off by appearances, by illusion. Like, one of my favorite stories is the widow's mite. You know, here are all the poobahs in the town throwing away the Warren Buffetts, you know, 99% of their billionaire. No. Here's this lady who gave away everything she had to live on. Warren Buffett's not going to do that. God bless him for all the stuff he is doing, in fact. But he's not going to do it. Bill Gates is not going to do that. Their kids are going to be born with silver spoons in their mouths. You can count on it. But Jesus was able to see, not quantitatively, but qualitatively. This woman was stunning in her generosity. A massive difference, of course. And then to go back to this great hymn to love, it's interesting coming from a broadcast of the Metropolitan Opera, Turandot, good old Puccini, my favorite guy on the operatic stage. So I'm not going to go through the plot of Turandot. It's sort of boring, silly. Anyway, but love is the answer. As soon as you kiss me, the heavens open, blah, 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 blah. Come on, folks. You don't find even a suggestion of that in this passage from Paul. Romantic love as we know it, as we embody it all the time. I've had enough weddings to know that whether the corsages fit, or whether the musicians are well-trained, or whether the bride's train is long enough, or how many brides may they have, these things that preoccupy brides and grooms, most of the time, was not an issue for these guys. This was bare-knuckled loving. You know, you don't laugh when somebody makes a mistake, you know. Love is patient. Love is kind. That's for everybody. That's not for married people. And married people often enough have enough stardust in their eyes they can't see anyway. Or that, if you'll allow me, that's my experience with weddings that last 3 months. Yeah. So we have to de-romanticize this glorious passage. We have to take away all the emotional props. Like it occurred to me when I was thinking about this all week, a little thought experience. Start a sentence. Love is. I kept coming up with, love is a feeling. As long as the feeling is there, then you're going gangbusters. Because the feeling, and once the feeling goes, of course, we're up to our 50% divorce rate in North America. Love is not a feeling. There's not a scintilla of a suggestion of feeling in this fairly bare bones description of love. Does not sit on its own way, is not irritable, resentful, does not rejoice in wrongdoing. That's my favorite one. Because Schadenfreude, that wonderful German word, which means you do rejoice when somebody else stumbles. You get pleasure out of somebody else's mistake. Freude is, of course, the German word for joy. And Schade is shadowy joy. That I'm very familiar with. So I can go, okay, I can be patient. Don't want my own way. But rejoicing in the truth? Then I hit a rough patch. I rejoice in getting my own way and being proven right all the time. You know? And I'm talking autobiographically. Everybody else can do what they need to do with this text. But please note, there are no orange blossoms, Mendelssohn processional music in this thing. It's just flat out. So you go out your front door, you see some bozo who cheated you last week because he overcharged you for his carpentry job. You don't go out and hit him over the head. In other words, Dorothy Day was absolutely right when she continually quoted, I think most of her life, at least after her conversion, that frightful line from Dostoevsky, love is a harsh and dreadful thing. Very different from love as, you know, some kind of elated, orgasmic feeling, you know. That's not love. If it's someplace down in the hierarchy of effects of love, I'll buy that. But it's certainly not primary. It's certainly not point one on the list. Does that discount emotional attraction? Lord, no. But it gives it its proper stature. Because it doesn't last. We all know that. It doesn't last. We even have that in the phrase, the honeymoon period is over. I mean, now, I want to beat the old bag on the head. Because the feeling is gone. This is so deeply embedded in our culture. It's very hard to see beyond it, I think. There was a great cowboy song a few years ago. Help me get back the feeling. Anybody recognize you? Probably you're too sophisticated a group to listen to cowboy songs. But that was the text. Help me get back the feeling. Because if the feeling's gone, we're blotto. You can forget it. So the next time you're at a wedding, or the next time you read this passage for yourself, it's 1 Corinthians chapters 12 and 13. It's really important to keep in mind what Paul was driving at. And that wonderful quotation from Dostoevsky as well.